I'm speaking today with State Representative Alan Cohen, who represents District 134. Representative, you are now finishing your second term in office. Has it been what you thought it would be?
You know, Charles, people have asked me that. And it was almost like when I ran the first time, people said, well, is it what you think it would be? And I said, you know, it occurred to me I never thought about what I thought it would be. I was running because I believed in what I was doing. And I never thought about it further ahead. So what I found to be interesting is the difference in the two sessions. The first session, I didn't know what to expect, and I had Speaker Craddock. And then the second session, I sort of had an idea of what it was going to be like. And as far as I'm concerned, it was considerably different with Speaker Strauss.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because I've been asking a number of your colleagues about it. What is, you know, from your perception, what is the difference between the House under Tom Craddock and the House under Joe Strauss?
Okay, well, from my perception, I mean, at the end of the session under Craddock, literally, there was a call by his own party to get up and walk out. I'm sure you remember that.
I do.
Yeah. And I sort of thought, I guess this is how it works, you know, this kind of rub and this kind of sort of hostility. And people kept saying to me, no, it's not. That's not how it works. But I only had that one example. Now that I've been through a session with Speaker Strauss, I see the difference. And I think there was a lot more camaraderie. There really was a lot of bipartisan efforts from my point of view on a lot of different bills. I thought that Speaker Strauss was much more open in saying to his committee chairs, hey, this committee is yours. You go ahead and do with it what you want. You know, it's yours to accept whatever hearings and bills that are coming before you. And I think in Speaker Craddock's time, it was much more, he sort of dictated what was going to go to the hearings, what was going to come out of the hearings.
So, you know, Strauss, as you know, was elected in large part on support from Democrats, and you know, there's been some complaints from some of his Democratic supporters recently. You may have seen a letter that Representative Jim Dunham sent around. What's your take on that?
Well, I think that Jim's made some good points. I think that at the same time, we are talking about two parties. You know, Joe Strauss is a Republican, and he's going to do that which benefits his party and keeps his party in a majority in the House. Jim Dunham is very much a leader in the Democratic Party, and he's going to raise those questions, and I think he's probably going to want to make sure that Joe doesn't take Democrats for granted.
Okay.
And furthermore, if we take over the House, then that'll be a different story as well. So.
Okay. In your first term, one of the things you campaigned on and accomplished was getting on a constitutional amendment that called for the issuing of a number of bonds, $3 billion worth of bonds, to fund cancer research.
Mm-hmm.
That was back in 2007. Can you give me an update on where that stands right now? How much of that money has been spent? Who's overseeing it? What's going on with that?
Well, that's the CPRIT bill, the Cancer Prevention Research Institute of Texas. And indeed, in fact, they just issued a report, and I'm happy to give it to you for your background information. Clearly the money has been issued, the bonds have been sold, the money is coming in as expected, but more, that's clearly important, I mean, no question. As important or more importantly is what's the money going for, and that is the research and the activity that people are putting forward in terms of what are they trying to do with the money, what kind of requests for proposals are out there, what who's responding, and it's, as far as I can tell, and not being, you know, in the medical field, we've got some wonderful proposals, and there's some wonderful programs that are being sponsored. It's run out of Austin. It's the leadership that looks at the proposals are people that are experts in their fields and not associated with any of the entities applying for the grants. So the grant committee is above all that, and I think from what I've gathered from the medical community, the scientific community, they're very happy with the way the process has been going, and I think it's an open process, and I think Texas is going to benefit, and frankly, Houston is going to benefit because, I mean, we have the medical center, and we know that a lot of those requests for proposals and grants are coming out of the medical center. So research is going to be devised here. Companies are going to move here to develop some of these projects. It's going to increase population. It's going to increase the tax base. I mean, I think it's great. And it's going to make a healthier Texas.
The measure was it passed easily and had the support of people like Lance Armstrong. The main criticism I heard of it at the time was that issuing debt to fund this kind of research was
right.
the wrong way to go about it.
That right.
it would be better to just appropriate the money. Can you speak to that?
I can only speak to the fact that I felt that the way we went ahead and did it was the way to go. And a number of my colleagues, whom I respect very much, felt that it wasn't. But I looked at the numbers, and I thought that it was the right way to go. And I think that it's working, and that's the best I can say. The process is working.
Okay. You were on the Appropriations Committee last session, and obviously the budget is the big issue going into this session. What is your perspective on the budget shortfall that the legislature faces, and how should it be dealing with it in 2011?
Well, indeed. I mean, we're going to be facing, there's lots of numbers out there, but for the sake of argument, and according to the chair of our committee, Jim Pitts, when he was in for a town hall meeting that I had, I mean, he used the number, $18 billion is the number. So let's talk about that. $18 billion is a lot of money to be in the hole. And that's what we're facing. Now, what are we going to do about it is there's going to be a lot of choices. Some of them are going to require cutting back on some of the things we're doing. Some of them are going to require looking at fees for some of the things that we haven't done yet. One of the other options is looking at something, and one could argue it's more or less this number, but $9 billion rainy day fund. There's going to be discussion about do we take all $9 billion and put it towards the $18 billion, if $18 billion in fact ends up being the number. If we do, we're not going to, it's not as if, you know, if it starts to rain, we're going to throw it through rainy day fund. It's not how it works. So we won't, if we use all that rainy day money, that's all that rainy day money, and we're not going to get it back for a long time. So we have to think about what's going to happen if we use that. It's going to be a huge challenge because typically people go after education and healthcare when they're coming back because those are our two biggest areas. And yet we're so far at the bottom in terms of providing services in the areas of healthcare and education that, I mean, just how much can you cut? And I'm very concerned about that.
Well, and aren't we constrained on some of these things because there's federal requirements or some of these
sure we're constrained
from the federal
if we don't put out some of the money, we're not going to get some of the money back. So I mean, if we don't put, you know, I think the numbers last time were, you know, where Chip was concerned, I think if we invested a dollar we get $2.67 back. If we don't invest a dollar, we don't get any money back. So I mean, we don't get the money from the feds for it. If we don't put money out for issues, or if we don't put money out for issues around Medicaid, we're not going to get money back. I mean, we have to invest money to get money back from the feds. And if we don't, then I think we fall almost twice as far as we would have.
Now, of course, one option that people have been discussing as a way of enhancing revenue going forward is expanded gambling in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
There's proposals for casinos, for allowing slot machines, video lottery terminals at horse racing tracks. Where do you stand on this?
Well, I think let's start with what you just said last about the racetracks. You know, when people go to the racetrack, they're not going there to see the ballet. They're going there to gamble. If they're going there to gamble, I can't see any reason why having slot machines there would make any difference. So I have absolutely no problem with that. In terms of gambling in general for Texas, I have a couple of thoughts on that. Let me begin with my overall one, and that is I will support gambling in Texas. And I do so with a couple of caveats, though. One is that there have to be money in there to provide services for people if they found themselves in situations where they become addicted, and there has to be Gamblers Anonymous and programs that are available. Secondly, I've looked at the numbers, and in this day and age, with the kinds of billions of dollars going over to Louisiana, New Mexico, and Nevada, my issue is if that kind of money is going there, we might as well keep it in Texas. It's not just what's being spent on gambling, but it's what's being spent on filling your car up with gas. It's what's being spent on gifts. It's what's being spent on food in these states. Finally, the effort not to do it, for Texas not to have gambling, will clearly be supported by a number of very well-meaning groups, and I understand that. But I also think some of the biggest money is being spent by lobbyists from Louisiana, New Mexico, and Nevada that don't want Texas to have money, to have gambling, because they clearly don't want to lose that revenue for their states. But if you look at the numbers are huge. We are we're losing an awful lot of revenue. Now, all of that said, I don't believe in balancing the budget of the state of Texas on the back of gambling, because I think that's the wrong way to do it. But the fact is, if we're going to be this kind of $18 billion in the hole, and there's an opportunity to have revenue that otherwise would, you know, we're not suddenly developing something called gambling, but to have revenue that otherwise would leave the state, to stay in the state, I think that's fine.
You've also been on the Appropriations Subcommittee on Higher Education, and as you know, before you were in the House in 2003, the last time Texas had a big budget deficit, they deregulated tuition for public schools, which meant that in return for them receiving less money from the state, they could charge whatever tuition they wanted. And tuition has gone up considerably at the public universities since then, which has not been very popular amongst those who want to send their children there. Do you believe that issue needs to be revisited?
I do think it needs to be revisited. I think any time we get to the point in our public school system where our children are not able to participate, even though intellectually they're gifted. But the cost of public higher ed in the public sector limits it, then I think we have a problem. I think one could argue that throughout history, anyone going to college that's needed additional funds has had to go out and work, and I know a lot of people who have. But at some point, we're having to look at kids who are, it's not just an extra job, you know, in the end while they're attending university. They have to literally drop out for 6 months or a year to accumulate enough funds to go back the next year and then drop out again until they can accumulate enough funds. I don't think that's the way we should be educating and challenging our children.
In the last session, Texas took some steps to create more Tier 1 universities. Can you tell me a little bit about that? Where do we stand on that, and what's next?
I'm very excited about that. I was very active in it. I was very supportive of it, and the people supported it. I think that I'm particularly excited about it because I believe that the University of Houston will be the next Tier 1 university. And just as we were talking about the money for CPRIT, for the cancer prevention research, again, with research, the same thing with University of Houston. There'll be more research projects taking place, again, attracting more people and more companies to the area. Fourth largest city in the United States, maybe to become the third largest city in the United States, absolutely has to have a Tier 1 university other than its private Tier 1 university, which is Rice, which is spectacular. But we need to have a Tier 1 university in Houston.
Okay. There's recently a news story about one of your colleagues in the Senate, Bob Duell, who asked Attorney General Greg Abbott for an opinion about legislation that he believes should be read to prevent any state funding from going to Planned Parenthood because of the law that is supposed to bar that to any organization that provides abortion. Now, Planned Parenthood is in some parts of the state the only provider of women's health or reproductive services of any kind, contraceptive and other women's health services in the state. Can you speak to this?
I think you have. I think you said it. Look, you know I'm a huge supporter of women's health services. And there is no question that the kind of services Planned Parenthood and others provide has really made a difference in the quality of life for women. And you know, abortion services get so mired in what the real work of Planned Parenthood is. It's one small, small piece of what they do. We're talking about other kinds of services that women need to have, whether it's providing them with contraceptive information, whether it's doing pap smears, whether it's doing breast examinations, and also services for men. I mean, you know, we're talking about women's health. And I think this idea that because Planned Parenthood is providing women's health services and, by the way, some end of termination services, is a reason to cut Planned Parenthood off from the kinds of services it's doing is absolutely absurd. Planned Parenthood, as far as I know, is very judicious in how it keeps any of its services separate. Separate entrances, separate doors, things that are clearly designed for women's health services and for termination services. And I think that, with all respect to my colleague in the Senate, that you know, this is an attempt to try and close down Planned Parenthood, and what it's really doing is making it so that women's health services are going to suffer tremendously.
And wouldn't it be the case that if he got the ruling he wanted and the Health and Human Services Commission adjusted its regulations accordingly, that the state would then have to pick up the slack and find some other provider for certain parts of the state?
Yes, that probably is. And why would you want to reinvent something that works, particularly in a time when we don't have money, when we are suffering, you know, under what, an $18 billion deficit? I mean, why would you want to go that route when something works? I mean, it's not that axiom about if it ain't broke, don't fix it. I don't mean that. But I mean, clearly there's absolute, unrefutable evidence that shows that the kind of services Planned Parenthood provides saves lives, keeps women healthy, and makes every child a wanted child. And why would you want to have to close that down and reinvent another service?
Okay. What would you say is going to be your big priority going into the next legislative session?
Well, and I had a feeling you were going to ask me about that. And I it's really hard for me to think in terms of a single priority, because women's health has always been, in general, health has always been an issue. The two areas that I sit on, appropriations and higher ed, are the two areas that I'm focusing most on, because the fact of the matter is, again, it's not my priorities. It's not my priorities. It's what is, I'm representing a district. That's the issue. I represent this district to the legislature, right? And not a party to the district. So what are the issues that district cares about? Last time it cared about the top 10% rule. That was huge, and we changed that. It cared about rebuilding UTMB. It cared about making sure that our emergency rooms are able to handle the numbers of people that are coming there. It cared about the Tier 1 university. So for me, it's sitting and listening to people in my district now and finding out what their biggest concerns are. And healthcare and education are two of the biggest concerns they have. So I'm looking at a number of issues people have come in to talk to me about, rural healthcare. There's just a number of things that this district cares about. And of course, the biggest issue will be my service on, if I'm reelected and appointed to appropriations, and the biggest issue is going to be appropriations and how we're going to manage to do what we need to do with less.
Okay. And, you know, one of the themes that you hear about in this coming election is the enthusiasm gap, that Republicans are more excited about voting than Democrats are. Do you see that in your district? And if so, how do you deal with it?
Well, I'm enthusiastic, and I don't see it in my district, because District 134 has the highest percentage of voters of any district in the state. It's the most highly educated district in the state. People, I mean, I don't have to send out notes and say, don't forget to vote. People vote in this district. And it seems to me that from people I've talked to, the majority of people are not rooted in any camp. They are really, really identified as almost independents, that they want to vote for that person or that proposal or that project that they believe most in, and not party politics. So I think we're going to see a good turnout. I think people are going to look at candidates and look at causes and not the politics of it. So I think after the election, we're going to sit down and talk, and I think the numbers will be high in terms of voter turnout.
How does having Bill White on the ticket affect your race?
Hey, you know, as they used to say, can't hoit. You know, I think it's great. I'm a big fan of Bill's, and I know a lot of people in our district, if they do identify as Republicans, many of them have said, you know, we're voting for Bill, we're voting for you. So I think having Bill at the top of the ticket can only help.
Okay. And when people go to vote in this election, why should they vote to send you back to the House for a third term?
Well, I'd like to think that they feel that I've represented the district the way it should be represented, that I've been honest in my dealings, that I've listened to their concerns, that I've made a difference on those issues that they care about. And that, again, as I just said to you before, I have represented this district to the legislature and not a party to the district. And I will continue to do so.
All right. Representative Ellen Cohen, thank you very much for speaking to me today.
Thank you.